Thank you very much. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for being here. So it's a great pleasure to be here and give this talk. I wanted to tell a little bit of a fairy tale. I want to tell you some story, some kind of story and metaphors, and I'm hoping it's a pleasant one. So let me give kind of the general plan. So I want to describe a perspective on a problem in number theory, the problem about describing L functions and specifically describing L functions by integrals. And the perspective I want to tell is one that's coming very directly from physical ways of thinking, from thinking about boundary theories for topological gauge theories. And this is a manuscript that I just put out recently with Yannis Akhilaridis and Akshay Venkatesh. Maybe the more informal description of the talk, I like to think of it as the kind of the revenge of the Gruppenpest. So in the 1920s, there was a phenomenon in the 30s that a lot of physicists were very unhappy, supposedly, about the influx of group theory and representation theory through quantum mechanics and the amount of that they had to learn. And you know, it's taken a few decades, but I feel like what's going on now, hopefully I'll try to convince you that we're gonna try to do the same back to representation theorists and to number theorists. That a very physical way of thinking inspired by quantum field theory, I think, is becoming more and more essential to problems that are central in number theory. And so the idea is to make the number theorists learn some physics. But so I'm going to describe how some problems in number theory appear. If you're not familiar with some of the number theory, I'm hoping I'll at least give you a caricature, but in the flavor and hopefully emphasize the physical structures that are appearing throughout. That is kind of the goal. So our first part is what is the relation between arithmetic and quantum field theory. Let me start with one of the central topics in number theory and representation theory, the theory of automorphic forms. What is the theory of automorphic forms? In kind of a brief way, say it, it's a problem in quantum mechanics. It's a quantum mechanics on a particular class of spaces, which are the arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. So we take a space like the upper half plane. Is this am I pointing? I don't know. Let's see. Does this work? This is the, okay. We look at the upper half plane, and we look at the action of SL2Z on it by modular transformations. This is the fundamental domain for this action. And we look at the quotient. And what we're going to do is going to study some version of quantum mechanics on this quotient space. And so we might study L2 functions on the space with a Laplace operator. Or we might study topological quantum mechanics. So most of what I'm going to talk about will be more closely modeled on topological quantum mechanics. We might study some cohomology of this arithmetic locally symmetric space. That's going to be the vector space. That's going to be the Hilbert space of our theory. And the spectral theory of the Laplacian on the space is basically the main topic of the theory of automorphic forms. So it's posed as a fairly classical problem in quantum mechanics on this particular class of spaces. But okay, well, before we go there, this has various lots of bells and whistles that I'll introduce as we go along. I wrote it down explicitly for SL2. There's a whole lot of arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. For example, you can replace SL2 by your favorite compact Lie group and complexify it. So there's a whole family of groups, the groups that we know with letters, GLN, SON, SBN, and so on. And for each of them, we have, in fact, many arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. So the quotient of, we take our Lie group, mod out by maximal compact subgroup, that's a symmetric space, and then we mod out by some arithmetic group, something like SL2Z. So these quotients, this collection of quotients, gives us a whole family of quantum mechanics problems, and that is what the theory of automorphic forms studies. Okay, so that's, if you'd like, a family of problems in quantum mechanics. The contention here is that what makes this theory special is that there's a lot more structure. This is a very, very special quantum mechanics problem. It has a lot of features that are not there kind of generically. So what kind of features? So the most important feature, the thing that really makes this a special problem, is that this Hilbert space carries, if you like, a quantum integrable system. There's a large family of commuting operators. These are going to be the observables in our theory. There's a particular class of commuting observables called the Hecke operators. So these are defined by some sum over cosets. These are kind of, these spaces have some kind of natural correspondences acting on them. They don't have any particular group symmetry, but they have some correspondence symmetry. And those define a whole collection of operators that kind of miraculously commute. And so what we might try to do is study, if you have a family of commuting observables, we know what we should try to do. We should try to simultaneously diagonalize them. And so the fact that this space has a lot of these commuting observables makes it a very special problem, has special features, again, maybe familiar from the theory of quantum integrable systems. So that's our basic feature. And so faced with a family of commuting operators, we know what to do. We should spectrally decompose them. And that has a fancy name. That's called the Langlands program. So we're going to look at these cohomologies of the locally symmetric space, or L2 of these locally symmetric space, and try to study the spectrum of the Heike operators. In other words, do some kind of Fourier transform for this family of commuting operators. And the contention of the Langlands correspondence is that the joint spectrum of these observables has a dual description that is of fundamental interest in number theory. Namely, the spectrum is given by representations of Galois groups of number fields. So here we could take F to be, in the example before, F would be the rational numbers. And we look at the Galois group of the closure of the rational numbers. So all the symmetries of polynomial equations with rational coefficients. And we look at the representations of this Galois group into some other Lie group. So this other Lie group is called the Langlands dual group, or the GNO dual group. And so the claim is that by studying representations into this group, we find the spectrum. These representations are exactly the kind of the joint eigenstates of these operators. So the collection, I think, I kind of skip over this classification. The data that labels these Heike operators, there's a bunch of Heike operators, they're labeled by a prime number. The prime might maybe something unfamiliar in the general story, but that's the label of it. It's a prime together with a finite dimensional representation of this compact Lie group. Okay. So that's the data. And that same collection of data you can realize very naturally. I'll explain them later in more gauge theoretic terms, but you can see these very naturally as giving functions on this spectrum. They're just some trace functions. So there's analog of Wilson loop operators. We describe this space of automorphic forms as functions on some dual space, some space of Galois representations, where we've simultaneously diagonalized all the Heike operators. We've made them into multiplication operators. Okay. So that's the fundamental contention of the Langlands program. It's relating this very representation theoretic and geometric problem to something that's of fundamental interest in number theory, which is Galois groups. So that's if you'd like just some particular feature of this quantum mechanical problems. Let me add a few more just for color. There's kind of a lot of more bells and whistles in this story, and the way it appears is there's lots of these arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. I said roughly they're labeled by Lie groups, but there are actually many of them. One of the data you can define is instead of looking at your congruent subgroup SL2Z, instead of your module group SL2Z, you could look at various subgroups of it. So these are the family of congruent subgroups. You can look at 2x2 integral matrices that satisfy some congruence conditions, modulo some primes. So you should be studying a family of these quantum mechanical problems. Even if you're interested in the upper half space, you're mostly interested in its quotient, not just by SL2Z, but by this family of groups. Okay, so that's one kind of feature. And another feature is instead of looking at the rational numbers, there's a family of other problems you can decide. You can replace the rational numbers by finite extension. That's a number field. And for each of these finite extension, you get a new family of locally symmetric spaces. So they're labeled. So these are all labels that go into this problem. Maybe a good example to keep in mind is an imaginary quadratic field. I could take the rational numbers and add the square root of some integer d, square root of minus d. That's an imaginary quadratic field. And in this case, instead of getting our familiar picture of the upper half space mod SL2Z, you get a hyperbolic three-manifold, an arithmetic three-manifold. You get this group becomes SL2C in that case. You get SL2C mod a maximal compact subgroup, which gives hyperbolic three space. And now we're looking at a quotient by a Bianchi group, an arithmetic group here. So that's another part of the same family. From this point of view, it's still labeled by the group SL2. But instead of looking at SL2 with integer coefficient, we're putting in this new field. Okay. So this is a collection of variants of this problem. And I think when one first studies this theory of automorphic forms, it looks like a big zoo. There's a lot of big structure, a lot of different things. And I guess what I want to contend is this metaphor of quantum mechanics is not kind of strong enough. I just think of this quantum mechanical problem. It doesn't really tell me I should be doing all these different things, all these different variants and all the relations between them, is not really well captured by saying, here's a quantum mechanics problem. However, the claim is that there is a good physics model that captures all of this structure. And that's what I'd like to describe. So the kind of paradigm for the theory of automorphic forms is that we should be studying not a quantum mechanics problem, but a four-dimensional topological field theory. And what I would like to convince you of is that this is a good way to capture all of the structure we know in the theory of automorphic forms and give some insights into it, moreover. So the kind of paradigm is that I fix my group G. My group G was maybe SL2. So I study SL2. I'm going to study the theory of automorphic forms for SL2, but maybe with the rational numbers, these imaginary quadratic fields, all of these number fields together, all of the different congruent subgroups, all of this data, claims it's all captured by one object, which I would like to call an arithmetic quantum field theory. So I'm not going to define for you exactly an arithmetic quantum field theory. I don't know what an arithmetic quantum field theory is. We have a two-month program at CMSA going on about arithmetic quantum field theories, and it's sort of this part of the idea is to try to figure out what it actually is. We really know one when we see one, and this is going to be one. But it's going to have features that are very closely modeled on four-dimensional quantum field theory, specifically four-dimensional gauge theory. So can be much more specific than that. The theory I want to describe, the theory I want to describe is sort of a version of four-dimensional n equals four super Young-Mills theory. So specifically, there's a way of making a topological, there are many ways, but a specific way of making a topological quantum field theory out of n equals four super Young-Mills, which is called the GL-twisted theory with parameter psi equals zero. If you want to be precise, we can discuss that in more details. So this specific topological field theory was studied by Kapustin and Witten in 2008 as a way of modeling what's known as the geometric Langlands program. So the geometric Langlands program was some kind of analog, or maybe poor cousin, of the original Langlands program in number theory, where the setting, instead of these number fields, had to do with geometry of Riemann surfaces. And Kapustin and Witten saw how S-duality for n equals 4 super Young-Mills gave you insight into this geometric Langlands program. What I'd like to do is kind of broaden this perspective and say that the ideas of four-dimensional gauge theory can be applied directly to the original Langlands program in number theory. So that's the kind of model that I'd like. So this is the theory, and I'd like to tell you, what do I mean by an arithmetic quantum field theory? What am I doing to n equals 4 super Young-Mills? What am I doing to this topological field theory that's arithmetic? Let me say at this point that there are specific features of this theory that are really fit very, very well with the study of n equals 4 super Young-Mills. But for much of this talk, if you're not very familiar with this topological twist of n equals 4 super Young-Mills, it's really I'm looking at features of four-dimensional quantum field theory, the structures in four-dimensional quantum field theory, and specifically four-dimensional topological field theories. That structure is what I'm going to be using. Okay. Let me pause for questions before I... please interrupt me at any point. So what I'd like to explain is where does arithmetic come from in this story? And this is based on an analogy. And I think the analogy was first introduced by Barry Maser in the 1960s. It was as fairly fanciful, though apparently it was one of the things that inspired Maser to move from low-dimensional topology to number theory. It was kind of on his mind when he made this transition. And this is an analogy that now goes under the name arithmetic topology. It's associated with Maser, Morishita, Kapranov, Reznikov, and now with Min-Young Kim. It's the first person who I think studied a kind of analog of quantum field theory in this context. And what is this analogy? The analogy is that these number fields, these finite extensions of the rational numbers, should be thought of as three manifolds. Now, that seems a little far-fetched. Well, what do I mean by they seem like a three manifold? Really, if you'd like, I'm thinking about them as rational functions, as functions on a three manifold. Right, so this I should imagine taking maybe their spectrum and thinking of that as some kind of arithmetic cousin of a three manifold. Now, under this, maybe I should add the rest of the slide, you might ask, what do number fields have anything to do with three manifolds, and why three? Where did one make this up? And the point is that this is what was discovered in the 60s, is that when you study cohomology of Galois groups, when you study the arithmetic of number fields, it satisfies a form of Poincaré duality. There's a duality there that makes it behave like the like Poincaré duality on a three manifold. So the kind of there's an arithmetic, the kind of topology underlying rings of integers of number fields looks like the topology of three manifolds. And people started taking this dictionary and adding more and more and more to it. And I think for a long time it was maybe viewed a little fancifully. For example, this is often known as the primes and knots analogy. So if you have a prime number in this story, a prime number is supposed to be the analog of a knot in your three manifold. And again, you might ask, what do primes have anything to do with knots? Again, there's something fundamental behind that, is the idea that a finite field, like something like Z mod P, so if you take a prime, you could take the integers and reduce it mod P, from the point of view of algebraic geometry, that behaves a lot like a circle. That's something fundamental about Galois groups. The Galois group of a finite field, up to some completion, is the integers. And there's this analogy that that finite extensions of fields are supposed to be thought of as covering spaces. So the FP has something like a family of covering spaces that look just like the covering space of the circle. So in some sense, the finite field plays a role of a circle. And so having FP as a quotient of the integers appears as embedding a circle into my three manifold. Again, that might seem a little far-fetched. And I think when it was first produced, I don't know if anyone took this terribly seriously. But it turns out to be extremely rich. And if you can take it a lot further, for example, there's analogs of two manifolds. Analogs of two manifolds in the story are local fields, like the completion at a prime P, or the real numbers, or Laurent series over a finite field. There's a bunch of fields, the local fields in number theory. They play the role of two manifolds. There's some one manifolds. You can make a repertory of objects, and there's some relations between them. We certainly don't have the full structure of the topology of three manifolds, but we have a lot of features. And what we're going to try to do is think about taking quantum field theory and evaluating it on new spacetimes. So the way I want to think about this is that some quantum field theories, some topological field theories, extend from our usual notion of spacetime to some more exotic spacetimes coming from arithmetic. But it has still a lot, the structure of the quantum field theory is preserved. And that's what we're going to try to use. Okay. So that's the idea of what I mean by an arithmetic field theory. So for example, so here, this is my notation for one of these arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. So before we were doing topological quantum mechanics on one of these arithmetic locally symmetric space. Now I want you to think about this from a four-dimensional point of view. We have a four-dimensional field theory that we're studying on, we're compactifying it on some three-manifold, and this is the Hilbert space I attach to a three-manifold times R. That's, so in other words, I have a quantum mechanics that I get from a four-dimensional field theory by reducing on this three-manifold. That's where my quantum mechanical problem is. So that already tells me I have some variables, right, in this quantum mechanical problem, which is the geometry of the three-manifold on which I'm reducing it. And that's how this field F, so the group G is playing the role of the gauge group. The role of this number field F is playing the role of which three-manifold am I studying my field theory on. So all of these different arithmetic locally symmetric spaces, I'm going to try to unify as just aspects of a single field theory. Okay. Yes?
Is there any anomaly that tells me why I get a locally symmetric space?
Yes, right. So why? So yes, there's a great question. So the idea is that this arithmetic locally symmetric space, so let me call it like this. Let me write a formula that doesn't literally make sense, but I want to claim that it's a moduli space of G bundles on, let me call it, I don't know if I call it X. Let's say X is the spectrum of the ring of integers of my field. So first of all, I feel the field, maybe I should make a geometric space out of it, which is the spectrum of its ring of integers. That's at least a variety. And you can try to make sense of some moduli space of bundles on it. So that's going to be my version of a space of gauge fields. And you'd like to make sense of this. This formula doesn't literally make sense for number fields. It makes precise sense for function fields, which, to be perfectly honest, all the actual work in our paper takes place in this middle setting of function fields, which is suppressed in this talk. In the case of function fields, this is a precise statement. In case of number fields, that you can write a description for this space of gauge fields by local trivialization data, which recovers exactly this idyllic picture of locally symmetric spaces. So that's why. So here I'm doing topology of the space of gauge fields, which you think maybe I should be thinking about symplectic topology of their cotangent bundle. Right? That's, I'm doing n equals 4. Okay.
Yeah. Question.
Yes?
So in this cosmos between the field and the manifold, really, is that Should I think it, there's a map, it's untrue, it's, what do we know about the
mapping,
or it's too naive to think?
I think people tried at some point, you know, initially people say, ah, the rational numbers are like the analogs of the three sphere, and can you have maybe the Poincaré, you know, I think it's not a great idea to try to directly map it. So I think there are analogies, but it's not like a particular number field gives you a particular three-manifold or vice versa. Really, what I think the better way to do it is just to think that there's more three-manifolds out there than we knew. Right? That in some sense, the class of three-manifolds is strictly bigger. There's ones coming from number fields. There's ones from coming from curves over finite fields. That's what I was saying. That's a part that I'm suppressing, but that's actually where most of the math really takes place. But there's just more three-manifolds out there, and nice TQFTs, I don't know how to tell you what nice is, but this is a nice one, extend from ordinary manifolds to these arithmetic manifolds. So I'm going to be evaluating the field theory on these new spacetimes. Yeah.
Well, yeah, Mark. Well, now, so at some point you said that, okay, you have TFTs on a three manifold, and then you reduce, dimensionally reduced to the original problem.
Yeah.
Okay, and there was also references to 4D topological theories or to 4D, yes, so it, now right now we're focusing on 3D topological theory.
Oh, no, I should be clear. My field theory is always going to be a four-dimensional field theory, and I'm going to reduce it on some three-dimensional spacetime cross R and get a quantum mechanics theory. So I'm taking the Hilbert space of this four-dimensional theory reduced on a three-manifold times R, right? So that's my Hilbert space at fixed time. My time in my story, by the way, it's going to be like 3 plus 1. Time is going to be time. Time is going to be usual time. It's just space is going to become this funny arithmetic thing. So my space is going to be my arithmetic three-manifold. Time is going to be ordinary time.
Okay.
So that's my. So it's 4 is as a 3+1 here. Yeah. Yeah.
Are there obstructions to putting a topological field theory on these arithmetic manifolds?
I mean, I think there are obstructions just even asking the question. I don't really know. I mean, I really believe this is a real theory. But at this point in its development, I don't know how to take a topological field theory and even ask the precise question of extending it to these other manifolds. The geometry of these manifolds is not developed in a way, it doesn't have coordinate patches and so on, the way that I can directly try to ask that question. So rather what I know is, so Min-Young Kim's work developed some analogs of arithmetic analogs of Chern-Simons theory. So there's some that's what's kind of spurred a lot of this. Here I'm going to tell you a lot about what n equals 4, twisted n equals 4 does on these spacetimes, but I don't really know how to ask a question directly.
But I guess, how do you know that you can put twisted n equals 4 there?
Because I know what it is, so to speak. I know what attached, so I'm going to tell you, I can tell you what the, you know, I know a lot about twisted n equals 4 in usual, ordinary world, and I can give you analogs of the Hilbert space on a three-manifold, the category attached to a two-manifold, local line surface operators, boundary theories. A lot of, that's what's going to be most of this talk. A lot of that structure, and that fits perfectly well with things we know about twisted n equals 4. So in particular, these representations of the dual group that will appear, that's an important feature. These Etoft operators in n equals 4 are going to be the Hecke operators. That's one of the observations of Kapustin and Witten. Okay? Okay. So, there's my next slide. So the main thing that makes this go, one of the things we know about n equals 4, well, I guess just we know in general, but Etoft operators, but these Etoft operators survive in this topological twist. So in this topological twist, there's an interesting collection of loop operators. And these loop operators are labeled, the data that labels an Etoft operator can be described as representation of this GNO or Langlands dual group. So that's the kind of the data of these monopoles. And so this matches perfectly well. In this picture, I'm going to think, this is my arithmetic three-manifold cross time, and I'm going to think about removing a knot. So this is going to be acting by a loop operator, and I'm going to introduce an Etoft monopole along this knot. That's going to give me an operator on the Hilbert space associated to my three-manifold. And now, again, in this analogy, knots are supposed to correspond to prime numbers. So this knot, I'm supposed to imagine that really there's some, I can't draw a knot in real time, so that's my knot. But that's supposed to be a picture of a prime number. So I'm going to pick a prime, and I'm going to introduce a defect along that prime. That the label of that defect is this representation of the dual group. And that exactly matches the label of the Hecke operators. So the fact that you have a collection of operators labeled by loops and representations of this other Lie group, that matches perfectly what you would expect from this topological field theory. And in fact, the fact that they're commuting operators, which from the point of view of the quantum mechanics, I just told them, tell you as a fact, there's a whole lot of commuting operators. From the point of view of four-dimensional TQFT, that's an obvious feature, just because you can move these knots around each other. Right? You have enough room in this four-dimensional picture to move these guys around, and that's the kind of commutativity of the OPE of these line operators in four dimensions. So the fact that you have a Hilbert space with a big commuting family of operators, that's completely natural from this point of view, and the labels of these operators fit well. Yes?
I also just make sure I understand. So that basically I should understand the Galois group at this prime to be the pi fundamental group.
Exactly, exactly.
It's not, and this representation tells me what the monotomy is.
That's, yeah. Well, no, the representation is, right, where these are Toffler loops, not Wilson loops. So the representation is telling me the link, take a little sphere around the monopole, and I see the geometry, you know, I get some classical solution of Yang-Mills equations around that sphere, and those are labeled by representations of the dual group. That's the kind of the, I don't know, Gauss law or something for this.
If I just have a line that's like open and it's not,
Absolutely. That's actually what was in the Kapustin-Witten story was studying of line operators rather than loop operators. Line operators naturally form a category because you can have interfaces between line operators, and that category is the full category of representations of this dual group. And there's a theorem called the geometric Satake corresponds how those operators are appearing in the theory of automorphic forms, which also fits perfectly. I'm not going to describe the theory on two manifolds, but if you study this theory on arithmetic two manifolds, you naturally see exactly those line operators appearing.
And they categorify as Heckel operators.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a big part of the justification. I gave a series of four talks last week on video at CMSA where I tried to go more slowly about all the different kinds of defects and how they match up. But with things that are known in the theory of automorphism. Though those talks were aimed more at number theorists. But okay. So the next kind of thing is the big bell and whistle that looked like a giant mess when I first introduced it, that all these collections of congruent subgroups. I take a bunch of primes and make all these congruence conditions at those primes, and those give me subgroups of my SL2Z. That's a big mess from the point of view of just quantum mechanics. From the point of view of this four-dimensional TQFT, it's again a completely natural feature, is that I can study my theory on a three-manifold where I can introduce some surface defects. Right? So here's my three-manifold, here's a surface defect, some kind of solenoid. I have, again, this is my prime P, if you like, that's my knot. I'm taking the knot cross time, and I'm studying the theory with a surface defect along that knot cross time. That's going to modify the Hilbert space of the theory on this three-manifold. And the claim is that these kind of two-dimensional defects were studied in the twisted n equals 4 setting by Gukov and Witten. They match exactly the data of ramification, this data of choosing congruent subgroups. So I don't have time to spell that out in detail, but all that collection of all these different spaces labeled by all these different congruent subgroups is perfectly naturally captured in the physics by just saying, let's study the theory with some collection of surface defects. Yeah?
So you might then support Tufte operators of a different type than the ones that are in the bulk.
Yes.
You see it.
Absolutely, yeah, that's a very natural object in this. Yeah, so there's all kinds of, so yeah, you might study these are, yeah, there's Hecke. When people in number theory mean Hecke algebras, they're not necessarily these commutative ones. This is the spherical Hecke algebra. There's these Hecke algebras associated to different congruent subgroups, and they get categorified exactly by the categories of line operators on a surface defect. And there's examples that are, there. The simplest example was worked out by Gukov and Witten, but there's a whole lot more. Okay. You can also talk about the local operators. There's not super exciting local operators in this theory, so I'm not going to talk about them right now. But the most interesting thing in the number theory matches with the most interesting thing in the physics here, which is S-duality. So that's, again, the idea of Kapustin-Witten in the geometric setting that we're trying to extend arithmetically, that there's a duality where these Atofta operators become Wilson operators for the dual group. So there's an equivalence between this four-dimensional field theory and another one. You might complain, why am I seeing two field theories? It's because I'm choosing a particular twist of n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and under duality, this twist goes to a different twist. So I'm just calling these A twist and the B twist. But you get, these theories are both 40 n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, just a different twist. There's a 40 n equals 4 for G and 40 n equals 4 for G dual, and electric magnetic duality is an equivalence of these field theories. So anything you calculate on one side will be identified with some calculation you can make on the other side. And the idea is that this is captured beautifully by, this beautifully captures the idea of the Langlands correspondence. So as before, like Kevin was asking, we have this topology of spaces of connections. That's the object we were studying on the A side. On the B side, this is the A and B, again, of course, are modeled by the A and B in mirror symmetry. The B side, we're getting some kind of algebraic geometry of spaces of flat connections. And these, the role of flat connections is now played by Galois representations. We should think of these Galois groups as some kind of as fundamental groups. And representations of the Galois groups be thought of as representations, as monodromy representations of fundamental groups. These are flat connections. So that's how the Langlands correspondent gets identified in this story. And so that's kind of the main insight, is that the deepest structure in the story matches perfectly with something that we know in the gauge theory, which is electromagnetic duality. So that, hence the title, this arithmetic electromagnetic duality. So you can make a big chart. I don't want to go in great detail, but this is some of the chart of the duality. Again, by the fact that I've twisted things, I'm seeing kind of one side is really a magnetic side. I remember I have a Tofte operators on one side. The other side is an electric side. I've kind of broken. I don't have both electric and magnetic phenomena on each side. But we have this automorphic side, which is called the magnetic side, the dual spectral side has electric phenomena. One side has these Hecke operators, which correspond to a Tofte operators. The other side has Wilson operators, which correspond to these trace functions that I discussed. And you can match up. On one side, you have topology of spaces of connections. On the other side, you have algebraic geometry of Galois representations. You have two-dimensional defects in both sides. You can match up all of your favorite structures. And it gives a very kind of fun way of capturing things. What I want to do today, though, what I'd like to do is tell you something, you know, how does this picture help you understand something you didn't before in the number theory? Okay. Right. And so where this is my work with Sekularidis and Venkatesh. What we're going to do is going to study, it's very kind of an obvious thing from the physics point of view. We understood one-dimensional defects and two-dimensional defects. Let's study three-dimensional defects, particular boundary conditions. Study boundary theories in the Yang-Mills theory and ask what happens. We know things about the electromagnetic duality for these boundary theories. What does that correspond to in number theory? And the claim is it's going to translate into the relation between periods and L functions, which I'm going to tell you about now. Okay. Questions?
Are the 3D defects going to affect the 3D manifold?
Yeah. So I'm again, my geometry is very restricted. The things I know how to make sense of arithmetically are very, so the, it's not quite only, but essentially the only kind of boundaries I'm going to look at is I'm going to take an arithmetic manifold cross time and put a boundary at one end, or you can think of a domain wall, but again, the domain walls will be just wrapping the whole arithmetic geometry. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you say something about like self-dual theories? Is there much to say at all?
I think there's a lot of interesting question. Unfortunately, essentially the only theory I know anything about is this theory, right? Is this particular theory. So there's a lot of interesting questions about how this relate to the, you know, the six-dimensional 2-0 theory or all kinds of other interesting theories. But I don't know at this point. The only thing I really know to tell you what correspond to a number theory is this particular twist of this particular gauge theory.
So like, for example, if I want to form dots of my gauge, then I should be able to also do that with these arithmetic things.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, anything you can do with the gauge group, you know, like look at different groups or domain walls relating theories for different groups and things like that, those will all have analogs in this theory. Yeah. Yeah. That's actually an extremely interesting aspect of this theory. It's going between different groups. It's called Langlands functoriality. Okay, so now let me tell you a little bit about periods and L functions. So again, what our work is about, it's about trying to apply this paradigm that I've discussed to a problem in number theory, which is the problem of writing L functions as integrals. And we're gonna, as I said, we're gonna study this as boundary, using the S-duality of boundary conditions, which was studied by Guyot and Witten for twisted N equals 4. Okay, so let me say something to, you know, what are L functions about? The kind of coarse thing to say is that they're the closest number theory has to partition functions. I'm saying this in a very kind of maybe, I don't know, loose way, is that they're the basic invariants that we want to calculate, and their naive definition is always nonsensical without some regularization. So that's a very, very loose analogy for partition functions. I hope to convince you that this analogy is better, that L functions really play the role of partition functions in this theory. But at least that's a starting point. You know, so a classical starting point you can ask is this question: how many positive integers are there? That's a natural question in number theory. So what is 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1? Infinitely often. And the answer, as you probably all know, there's negative 1/2 integers, right? And now you can ask, you know, for example, where did the 1/2 come from? The numerator is really the rank of the group of units of the rational numbers and the class number of the rational numbers. That's a fancy way of saying 1. 2 is the number of roots of unity of the rational numbers. So it's plus minus 1. So there's reason behind this 1/2. But, you know, obviously the way I pose the question is nonsensical without some theory of renormalization. And the way it's done is by the Riemann zeta function. Right, so we add an extra parameter, we add this s parameter, we make this sum the sum over 1 over n to the s. I was looking at zeta of 0. I was trying to evaluate zeta of 0, but I add this extra parameter, and this series analytically converges in some half plane, and I can analytically continue and make sense of 0. So this is something I think is very familiar in quantum field theory, literally for the zeta function. Okay, so this is the context. The Riemann zeta function is the fundamental example of an L function. This is the basic example. Before we go to other L functions, I want to point out that I gave you a definition of the zeta function, but what's interesting is that it has two descriptions, which I want to claim are kind of an electric and magnetic dual description. There are two dual ways of thinking about the zeta function. One is Euler wrote the zeta function as an infinite product over prime numbers. So this is the Euler product description. And this encodes, this tells you why the zeta function is interesting. It tells you things about the behavior of prime numbers. So it encodes something about the collection of prime numbers through this infinite product description. And I'm going to try to convince you that this is kind of the electric version. And then Riemann wrote an integral for the zeta function. He wrote it as some kind of Mellin transform of the theta series. So this is the integral formula. So it's up to some annoying factor. It's basically this integral of a theta series. And this, the reason this is useful in particular is it's why I know about the analytic continuation. It's easy to see the analytic continuation of the zeta function once I write it as this integral. And this allows me to evaluate it at 0. So by writing it as an integral, I get good access to its analytical properties. And this has direct relations to representation theory. So these two kind of dual manifestations of the zeta function is what I'm eventually trying to convince you have analogs. There's going to be two sides of the duality are going to give you two aspects of these zeta and L functions. And the relation between them is what I'm going to try to capture. Okay. So let me just briefly say something about L functions. L functions are generalizations of the zeta function. They recover the zeta function for the case where there's a trivial representation. So the L function will involve some extra data. It'll be a function of a representation of the Galois group. We take our Galois group and we take our representation, which again I want you to think as some version of a flat connection. We take this representation, and to such a data, we fix that data, and we fix a finite dimensional representation of my group G, check. To this data we attach a number. I'm really going to be interested in this L value at 0, but again I'm going to think of it as a function of this auxiliary parameter S. And again, it's some version, I don't know if the details of this formula are terribly crucial right now, but again, it's an infinite product over primes of some kind of inverse characteristic polynomial. Okay? You take a characteristic polynomial of this Frobenius element, which is this going around, this monodromy around my prime as a circle. So we have these little circles, which are my prime numbers. They have a monodromy around them. That's what this Frobenius, and I'm taking some characteristic polynomials of those operators. Okay, some kind of Wilson loop operators there and taking their characteristic polynomial. Okay, so this is very schematic, what an L function is. And the claim is there's a whole lot of this important conjectures in number theory about these L functions. The L functions are a way of capturing some of the deepest things we know about algebraic geometry, about solutions, polynomials, equations over the rational numbers. So for example, the Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture is exactly a question about the value of 0 of one of these. Now, on the other hand, what are periods? Periods are kind of a family of integrals that are generalized, this Riemann's integral. So for example, if you take a modular form, a function on the upper half space that's invariant, suitably covariant for this SL2Z, you can perform some integral of this. So I wrote two such integrals. There's a blue contour and a red contour in my picture. So it could take a function on the upper half space, maybe invariant on Sl to Z, and you can integrate it around the red contour. That ends up being the constant term in the Q expansion of my form. That has a name called the Eisenstein period. The period that's more relevant to us here is this kind of Mellin transform integrating around the imaginary axis, this blue contour. And that's called the Hecke period of the modular form. So just I'm going to take my form and integrate it, maybe against some weight, along this blue axis. And this is, I'm labeling it the G mod T, the T period, where T is the diagonal matrices in SL2. The idea is that the inclusion of this vertical axis is an orbit for the diagonal matrices. So I'm going to label this by the diagonal matrices in SL2, or really by the cosets of SL2 for diagonal matrices. So that's how I'm going to label this particular integral. So this is a fundamental measurement, if you like, that I can make of an automorphic form. I can calculate some integrals. Okay. And the point is that this is kind of the way these things come in, is that L functions are the things you really care about in a lot of algebraic number theory, but you don't really have direct access to them analytically. I want to care about, for example, their value at zero. I need to analytically continue them. I need to know some analytic properties of these, and these are extremely mysterious and deep conjectures in number theory. You have access to them if you can write them, if you can give them an integral representation like Riemann did. So this is the kind of the caricature. We have basic states we can make, basic measurements on these automorphic forms, these integrals, that's these periods, the way of getting complex numbers out of automorphic forms. On the other hand, we are interested in getting these L functions, these measurements of these Galois representations, and they're supposed to be exchanged under the Langlands correspondence. Okay. Does this make sense schematically? Is a question? Right. So, I didn't really say what x is. Yeah, so I'm going to say more about x. So here, I'm thinking of g was maybe SL2, and I'm acting on x, which is g mod diagonal matrices. So x is playing the role of this, the labeling this blue contour, this imaginary axis. So x is, but I'm going to label these integrals by g spaces. So given a g space, you can write down some integral. I'll say a little bit more about that. And that that integral is. It's a way of measuring my automorphic forms. I'm going to integrate them on some contours. And I'd like to match those integrals with L functions of Galois representations, because that's what Riemann did. In fact, it's not just what Riemann did. It's what Hecke did. And what Hecke did, so if you're familiar with the story of the Shimura-Taniyama-Wei conjecture and Weil's work, there's supposed to be a matching between modular forms and elliptic curves. And under this elliptic curves give you certain, these are give you special Galois representations. And under this matching, this integral, that's exactly this blue contour integral, is supposed to match with an L function for the corresponding Galois representation. And that's in some sense the main content of the Shimura-Taniyama conjecture. So the L function of an elliptic curve can be written as an integral in this picture. So that's the kind of statement we'd like, generalizing Riemann's integral formula. Okay, this is a known result. And there are many results of this kind that are known. So what am I trying to talk about? What could physics help me in this problem? And, well, okay, let me add one more slide. So there's, to answer your questions, there's a lot more. What is this x? I fixed a G space X. Here, G was my SL2. X maybe was G mod the diagonal matrices. But you can write down an integral for any of these space. For example, Riemann's integral, as interpreted by Iwasawa and Tate, becomes the case where the group is GL1 and acting on just the affine line. That's my X. So it doesn't need to be a homogeneous space. In fact, it wasn't in the Riemann case. So that's why I'm labeling it by X and not by the subgroup. And this is how you can take Riemann's integral formula, and Tate and Iwasawa generalized it to all of these cases, to a big family of these kind of abelian L functions. Okay. So there's this family of integrals. That's what periods are. But here's the problem I want to talk about. This is kind of what I want to apply. You know, I'm sorry if this is a lot of words that maybe are not familiar. Hopefully the structure is familiar, and what I want to focus on is what the structure is here. We have some family of integrals we could do for automorphic forms. There's these interesting L functions. these are interesting measurements we can make of Galois representations, but the data that label the two kinds of measurements are don't look like they have any relation with each other. The basic data that's labeling the two sides doesn't match. On one side, we have these contours, and generally they're labeled by some G-spaces. On the other side, all I needed to fix when I wrote an L function, I had a Galois representation, all I fixed was, you know, this finite dimensional representation of a compact Lie group that's dual to my original group G. Those are the data. And so you might ask, which L function should match with which period? How am I supposed to even know when to relate an L function to an integral? And there's kind of a big art of this. There are many, many formulas like this in the number theory literature, but it's kind of a zoo. And what one of the goals of our project is try to systematize to understand how do you really know which data on the arithmetic side should match with which data on the anamorphic side. And this is what we're proposing a solution using S-duality. Okay. Okay, does the problem make some sense? When did I?
We started with 5 hats.
Okay, so I have.
That's the meeting is going on for 5 hats.
Okay, great.
Your next meeting is about 6 hats.
Okay, good. Okay, so now let me now say a little bit about what our work is, and the kind of the main claim in our work with Sekularidis and Venkatesh is the idea that both these measurements of periods and L functions are not isolated things you do. It's just not an isolated contour here and an isolated infinite product there. They're both very structural. They're aspects that extend to what I want to say is an entire boundary theory for this topological field theory. Just like before, I was saying these random collection of Hilbert spaces for arithmetic locally symmetric spaces all kind of cohere, all their structure coheres into the structure of this four-dimensional TQFT. I want to claim these measurements are measurements that are given, or like the states that are given those measurements are actually boundary states for a boundary theory. And they cohere in it this way, and that predicts a lot of structure. And then we can apply the Gyota-Witten electromagnetic duality for boundary theories to make a prediction which period should match with it, which L function. That's kind of the executive summary. And this captures a whole lot of structures in what's been come to known as the relative Langlands problem. There's a whole lot of questions of which these periods and L functions are part. There's kind of a science behind them that we want to encode fully inside of the theory of these boundary conditions. Okay. So just a kind of a little review of what some things we learned from Gyota and Witten. But under this electric magnetic duality for four-dimensional gauge theory, well, if you take an equivalence of field theories, you know a boundary theory, and one is going to go to a boundary theory and the other. We're going to study particularly these kind of half BPS boundary conditions in the super young Mills, but really topologically twisted. So we can think of topological boundary conditions for these topological field theories. And one thing that I learned from Gyota-Witten paper is I can construct boundary theories for this theory from coupling the theory to sigma models in three dimensions. So I can study a three-dimensional sigma model into a particular kind of space, looking at a class of G spaces. I want this to be a supersymmetric three-dimensional sigma model, so I need this target to be hyperkähler. Though for the topological theory, I only need holomorphic symplectic. And to relate, to couple it to the G theory, we want this not to be just a symplectic space, but a symplectic space with an appropriate Hamiltonian G action. Okay. So that's a way you can produce boundary theories this way. That's one thing we learn. The other thing you learn is that you can also extract Hamiltonian spaces for the dual group out of the same data by evaluating Coulomb branches, by looking at moduli spaces of vacua for these boundary theories. So by studying this boundary theory and making the right calculation, thinking about local and line operators that live on my boundary, I can detect this Coulomb branch for the theory, which ends up being a Hamiltonian space for the dual group. This was made mathematically precise in the work of Braverman, Finkelberg, and Nakajima. And so very roughly speaking, if you look at the Gyota-Witten picture from a long distance, which is where I was, you see in a distance that you have Hamiltonian spaces for group G and Hamiltonian spaces for group G dual. And you might dream that there's some kind of pairing between these G actions on spaces and G dual actions on spaces. What the actual physical picture is in general is much more complicated. But from a coarse level, that's what this is predicting. You have a G space and a G dual space, and you might hope that there's a duality between these spaces. Now, what we want to do is think about these three-dimensional boundary theories on both sides and interpret them arithmetically as giving periods and L functions. Okay. So let me start on the magnetic side, the automorphic side. So the idea is that you can rewrite this period integrals. So we have these period integrals appearing. You can think of what are you integrating over, and try to interpret, just like we interpreted these arithmetic locally symmetric spaces as space of gauge fields. What you realize is that you're integrating over some G-twisted maps into X. So we have you have your spacetime, you have some principal bundle for your group G, you can look at a map into X that's twisted, but if you like, you have some background field for G, and you're twisting by that. So that's exactly the partition function of a 3D sigma model, sigma model into the cotangent bundle of X. So I'm thinking of the periods for GX, they appear like partition functions for this three-dimensional sigma model coupled to my G gauge theory. So you can interpret periods this way. You can make this very precise, again, in the function field setting. You can write down what these integrals are, or in the geometric setting. And that gives you a kind of an understanding of that the periods are not just an isolated object. They should be part of an entire boundary quantum field theory, which is with all of its structures. So this is what I'm schematically calling the automorphic quantization. And again, I've switched my data from X to M. Before, X was maybe G mod a subgroup. But now I'm thinking I should really be thinking about its cotangent bundle. And that's the data that's labeling my boundary theory. That's the space that would appear in Gayota-Witten. So this is this 3D A model, if you want to make sense of this as a topological field theory. Now, you can ask why the cotangent bundle, and this has an interesting history. I mean, it has the point is that when we're doing quantum mechanics on this X, it's really something microlocal. It's really about its cotangent bundle. And this is already appears in number theory in Tate's proof of the functional equation for Riemann's zeta function. That uses a Fourier transform, and that's somehow secretly saying that Tate wasn't really studying the affine line, he was studying its cotangent bundle and doing quantum mechanics, the quantization of the cotangent bundle. So replacing X by M gives you a lot more symmetry, a lot more examples, a better understanding of the structure. So that's one step. I don't have time, I think, to describe. There's a much richer story, what happens in codimension 2. This is when we put in arithmetic two manifolds instead of three manifolds, and this relates to a big subject, which is harmonic analysis over local fields. But let me skip that. I can return if there are questions at that. And this boundary theory, you can use it to capture a lot of the things people care about in that theory. You can formulate a lot of the basic questions of harmonic analysis as questions about this boundary theory. But maybe the more interesting thing to talk about is L functions. So again, what we want to claim is that you should think about these L functions as partition functions of my four-dimensional theory on an interval where I put in some boundary condition. So the idea, again, that you can rewrite this formula. I wrote this big characteristic polynomial formula. I defined an L function in a way that, to me, was completely opaque as not a number theorist. And part of the idea of what we're trying to do is trying to understand where that formula comes from geometrically. And what that formula means geometrically, it's a volume. It's an integral. It's a volume of some space of twisted maps. Again, it looks like a partition function for a sigma model with some background field. So here we have a 3D model. Now we're on the B side. We have a Rozansky-Witten theory into a holomorphic symplectic space. And you try to understand what its partition function is. And the point is that you can see these formulas for L functions appearing as these kind of volumes. So that suggests, again, that the theory of L functions is really part of a boundary theory for this four-dimensional space. And you can, again, where did this Hamiltonian G space come from? In the classical theory of L functions, there's no Hamiltonian spaces. There's no really even varieties. There's just a vector space, right? So the basic data before, we had a representation of the dual group. That's what labeled this L function. What we're saying, don't think of this as a representation. Think of it as a variety. Think of it as a G space. And then, in fact, don't even think about take its cotangent bundle. So the relation to the classical data in number theory is you take this vector space, think of it as general nonlinear, take a nonlinear version, take its cotangent bundle. Now you have a Hamiltonian G dual space. And now you're in business, right? Because we had this idea from Gayota and Witten that Hamiltonian G spaces and Hamiltonian G dual spaces should match. If you rewrite the theory of L functions, the theory of periods, both in terms of Hamiltonian actions for dual groups, now you can make predictions about the matching. So I guess I still have a few minutes. Let me just say very, very coarsely, where did L functions, I won't deduce this, but like try to explain why did L functions have anything to do with these kind of volumes. And the basic, remind us, what is the characteristic polynomial? Just to back up for a second, right? you can think of the characteristic polynomial as a trace, right? Rather than think of this determinant, you can think of it as a trace of an operator on, so the characteristic polynomial of an operator f on a vector space V, I can think of as a graded version of a trace on the exterior algebra of this vector space. Okay. So, and again, when I think about this exterior algebra, maybe I should think quantum mechanically. I should think of this as a spin representation associated to take V plus V dual as an orthogonal space, take its Clifford algebra, this exterior algebra is this spin representation. So that at least you're seeing that there's some quantization secretly there. Now, in the L function story, we have these inverse characteristic polynomials appearing, one over, but the same kind of interpretation works, just a superversion. Instead of an exterior algebra, an inverse characteristic polynomial is a trace on a symmetric algebra. And again, it has the same kind of interpretation. Now we have an even symplectic space. Take V plus V dual, take its quantization, and take a trace on there. So that's kind of fundamentally where this quantum mechanical interpretation is coming from. That lets you identify these traces as eventually at certain volumes. So let me not go into that in detail. That's just at least a connection to reality. Okay, so let me say a few more words about where this goes. So again, like I was trying to explain, that one of the consequences of the geometric perspective, we're extending this theory of L functions. We're extending its domain from representations to arbitrary varieties with an action of this group. And then you say, actually, it's about their cotangent bundles. And then rather than restricted cotangent bundles, you might try to extend it further to things that are not polarized, to Hamiltonian actions of the group that are not necessarily polarized. And the idea is that should be really the domain of the theory of L functions rather than just these vector spaces. And again, by saying it this way, you're encoding a lot more symmetry. You're encoding this kind of Hamiltonian symmetry of this cotangent bundle, this symplectic space. And there are many examples in number theory that didn't quite fit into the previous version that this covers. So it's a better way of thinking of the domain of the theory of L functions. And so now here's kind of our big kind of picture. This is what we call the relative Langlands duality. It's saying that, first of all, that if you take this duality for boundary theories in a very, very special case, so there's a class of Hamiltonian spaces which we call hyperspherical. I'll say a couple of words what that means. There's a class of varieties we call hyperspherical varieties under which this kind of Gyota-Witten duality becomes something really a duality between Hamiltonian actions. There's a G space M. It actually has an honest G dual space M check, and that this is a duality. Okay, so that's the first claim. And the interesting statement then is that under electric magnetic duality for these four-dimensional gauge theories, the boundary condition associated to one is identified with the boundary condition associated to the other. So in other words, the theory of M periods associated to this Hamiltonian G space M matches with the theory of L functions associated with this space M dual. So that's the basic claim, that this gives you a collection of formulas that says this integral equals this L function, but it also gives that as a result of something much, much more structural, this full structure that's implicit in saying a boundary theory. Okay. This is a conjecture. I should say we don't prove this, but this gives a lot of predictions. Maybe this is just to throw a slide with a lot of stuff on it, just so it looks like there's. I don't want to spell out, but there are many, many, many predictions that you can spell out of this kind of principle, and we spend that in our book. And this is some of it, but let me skip this. I'm happy to share the slides, but so let me comment a little bit about what's more concrete here. Is that this dual variety M check is not something random, right? We know how to build it. It's supposed to be this Coulomb branch of the original theory. So you can build it directly as a modular space of vacua, again, following this Braverman and Finkelberg and Kojima idea. So you take some algebra of local operators living on this boundary theory, and you make that holomorphic functions on the space. That's what this dual is. So the M-check is related in a very precise way to the original theory. But then the idea is that we take, we think about what that formula means. This Coulomb branch formula has an interpretation in terms of a harmonic analysis. It's directly related to the Poincaré measure in the study of these spherical varieties. So it's something you can identify arithmetically, and therefore you can make very precise conjectures, very precise predictions using things we know in harmonic analysis to what exactly this dual space M-check should be in terms of your space M. So we give a formula for what this M-check should be that gives makes this a precise conjecture about what which L functions should relate to which periods.
Can I ask you, so
yeah.
This Coulomb branch construction is always a non-affine variety.
Yeah. That's right. So our construction is, yeah, we always get an affine variety. I mean, by construction, we're defining it just as an affine variety. And if you'd like, that's one of the conjectures. One of the aspects of our conjecture is saying is that this is the right variety. So in other words, you're not forget. You could have tried to look at line operators rather than just local operators and get something richer. We're saying that in these cases, these duals are actually these affine varieties. I mean, we make very strong restrictions, as I said, about what inputs we put in. In general, you wouldn't expect to just know things just by local operators on the boundary. But we conjecture in our case, and this is backed up by a lot of evidence, that this is the right answer.
So these affine are both affine, right?
That's right. In our condition, M and M-check are both smooth and affine and extra conditions, where we believe that a lot of those conditions should be able to drop. We make very restrictive conditions where we can make very precise conjectures. The picture should be much, much more general. But in our case, M and M-check are both smooth. So they satisfy these very strong finiteness conditions. This is this hyperspherical conditions. So it tells you what kind of thing. So the example is you can think of hyperspherical as supposed to be analog of hypertoric varieties in non-abelian case. Examples are cotangents of spherical varieties. It's late in the day, so late in the talk, I guess. So there's a whole lot of examples. I can say what a spherical variety is, but there's lots and lots and lots of examples of these. And a lot of examples that are relevant to things in number theory, though they have names associated with them. So it's a big class of spaces that covers a lot of things we care about from various problems. So let me just close by saying, once you have this picture, so that's the end of our story, but now it suggests many, many more questions, where you just take the physics of these boundary theories, and there's a lot of very natural questions you should ask, like, what happens about domain walls rather than boundary theories? That's the theory of Langlands functoriality. What about putting surface defects? So there would be a ramified version of these boundary theories that we haven't explored as much. What about interfaces between boundary theories? That's a really interesting structure that various examples in number theory seem like they are captured by interfaces between boundary theories, but this seems to be a way of organizing a lot of new phenomena. That's something we're working on. You can study anomalies. You can study I haven't talked about the non-pole boundary conditions. They have, again, an arithmetic interpretation. You could try to lift things from 4D to 5D. There's a lot of questions that are suggested by this physics point of view, and that's kind of what some of the things I'm thinking about right now. But I think that's a good place to end. Thank you.
So appreciate it. Any other questions? I can ask you just in this analogy with topological field theories, do you have a dictionary for like cobordisms?
Yeah, that's unfortunately one of the things we don't know. Interesting cobordism. I mean, there's a very few cobordisms of arithmetic free manifolds we know around. So that's we don't have as rich a structure. There's we know the complement of a knot, that kind of thing, and filling it, adding the solid torus or whatever the neighborhood of a knot. There's the kind of places where some of the deepest results have been proved in this kind of context are the analog of a mapping torus. If you have a fibered three-manifold, if you have three-manifolds, we take a diffeomorphism of a surface and take the mapping torus. Those are what appears in when you study function fields. Those are those analogs of function fields. And there you have a precise prediction, which is some kind of trace of this monotropy, that everything you evaluate will be given by a trace of this operator. And those correspond to very deep theorems that are in the mathematics literature. So that's a kind of TFT structure we see in crossing with circles or twisted products with circles we see. And there are other pieces, but the main thing that I know how to see is the structure of defects of various dimensions. Cobordism at this point I think some people are trying to develop that theory, but I think at that point this is still fantasy. Yeah.
There
are people now. There have been a couple of papers already proving some of these predictions. One of the things you could do, for example, that's really fun in this way is One of the greatest insights from physics to number theory and in general to the Langlands program is, you know, in the Langlands program, the two sides look extremely asymmetric, right? They look completely different universes. While in the physics, you know, they're both just N=4/Mills with maybe different twists. So that symmetry is extremely enlightening. So the idea that you should think of this other side in an equal footing. And so one thing you could do is just take your favorite example of an integral formula, this L function equals at this period, now switch the roles of the two Hamiltonian spaces. And you get a completely unrelated new prediction of an integral formula. Some of these are known, some of these are new, and I think, like, you know, Eric Chen is a student of Venkatesh, and Venkatesh proved some of the, you know, there are examples. That's an example of the kind of thing you can do, is you can generate new examples just by taking your favorite example and switching the two sides. There are other, I think, statements that are being done in everything. Our book is not in the number field setting. We do everything in function field setting. We can make precise conditions in the number field setting, we really have to think much more carefully about the Archimedean primes, which are sort of their own beasts. But we've made some of those predictions we made in the function field setting have now been proved also. It seems to produce a lot of, it definitely produces a lot of conjectures, and they seem to be true. but there's some evidence, but yeah.
Sorry. Maybe just to orient myself, the X space that you're thinking of, in regular gauge theory, that would be Bungee, for example.
Let's just fix our notation. So my X, so I had a group G, and my X is the X for data that's labeled in the boundary theory, right? So I'm thinking about, the theory, the G theory has to do with moduli space of G bundles. But now I'm picking some extra data, which is a Hamiltonian G space, or maybe just a G space. That's my X. And that's defining some boundary theories in my theory. So for example, on the A side, there's something called the Gayotte-Lagrangian. There's, you know, there's a particular brain in the Hitch and moduli space that you can attach to a G space X, or Hamiltonian G space. So the particular boundary conditions. So on a Riemann surface, it's given particular objects in the theory evaluated on there. And so, for example, you would like to describe where does that go under S-duality? There's sort of a dual object on the B-side, which we describe.
So would it be possible to, under this duality, to get a Lagrangian in the Bungee over a regular three-manifold, and then you dualize it to something over the arithmetic three-manifold? Would that be possible?
Unfortunately, the duality, you know, it fixes the geometry of the underlying space. So. The data of these boundary theory gives you objects in every possible setting of this Langlands correspondence, gives you geometric, arithmetic, local, global. So it gives you a collection of objects, but the information flow between the arithmetic and geometric one is kind of more subtle. They relate in some ways, especially when you look at local fields, they kind of talk to both in some sense, but it's not sort of a direct line that way.
So maybe it's wrong question, but you had some cotangent bundles, so probably you can quantize it.
Yeah.
And then, like, what would you get on both sides, inside of periods and on side of functions?
Right. So I mean, it depends what you mean by quantize it. One way to ask your question. So really, I'm thinking of this cotangent bundle. I'm quantizing it to a three-dimensional quantum field theory. I'm thinking of it as, you know, I'm looking at maps into it, right? So that those are my fields are maps into this. So that is already a quantization process. So this boundary theory is a quantization of the symplectic space, but quantization as a three-dimensional quantum field theory rather than a quantum mechanics. But another question you can ask is about deformation quantization in a kind of more traditional sense. And that does play a role, that has a natural role in the local theory, that quantization is given by putting on basically an omega background by putting some equivariance for some circle rotation. So you can implement that quantization that way. And you can see that on both sides. And so you can make predictions this way about sort of quantization of M and quantization of M dual being related. Those conjectures are not formulated in our book, but you can see that deformation quantization parameter very naturally from this omega background picture, and then you could just put the duality on there and you can make some predictions.
Well, Okay, so if there's no further questions, let's thank David.
Thank you.